from WNPR. I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
Being an American involves the embrace of high ideals and civic responsibility.
Everything you said today was absolutely untrue.
I mean, you said he's an untruthful president. Yeah. Are you calling no question?
Yeah, no question.
If you elect to call a family like this, it is about the most difficult thing you could imagine. There's no perfect way to make that phone call.
U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson showed up unannounced in two countries yesterday, Afghanistan and then Iraq.
The Hillary Clinton campaign and the DNC. What exactly did they do?
Well, I mean, they have a lawyer, and that lawyer went about looking to hire research firms.
If you want to get into a debate with a four-star Marine general, I think that that's something highly inappropriate.
What happens if stability fails to assert itself in the face of chaos and instability? If decency fails to call out indecency? Were the shoe on the other foot, would we Republicans meekly accept such behavior on display from dominant Democrats? Of course we wouldn't. And we would be wrong if we did.
We'll be touching some of those issues later in the program. Right now, you can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, at WNPR Wheelhouse. We're going to start a little bit with state politics and a lot of news there with Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Howdy, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Liz Caradowitz is here. She's Republican political analyst. Hello, once again, Liz.
Good morning.
And Christine Stewart, who's editor-in-chief of CTNewsJunkie.com. Hello, Christine.
Hi, John.
Well, there's a lot going on. Christine, why don't you just get us started off? So, I'm going to start with this because this is the most fun we can have right now. We've been following this process for quite some time. You've been following it much more closely than we have. I think to all of us, it's been a kind of a painful process trying to figure out how Republicans and Democrats, the two chambers of the legislature, how the governor is going to insert himself and how we're actually going to come together on a budget deal. I think we finally heard from Senator Martin Looney exactly just how bad it is.
This has been a really a painful process, almost like having a prolonged tooth abscess that you weren't able to get to the dentist to resolve. But finally, we think that we're at the point where it will be extracted, and what we'll then have is a combination of exhaustion, pain, and relief.
That's an inspiring little speech.
And be flooded with pus.
Exactly. And so, now that we've had this abscess and this incredibly painful process, what is the now somewhat a pussy resolution here? What happened yesterday, Christine?
Well, we're going to have to take our antibiotics.
Yes, exactly.
Maybe find some Novocaine.
Yes, maybe some Novocaine would be good.
Yes.
It's interesting that they were able to come to an agreement and they both gave. It was truly a compromise. And, you know, neither Republicans or Democrats love what's in this budget compromise, but it's almost November. They have to get something passed, and they knew that they wouldn't be able to get to that bipartisan agreement with Governor Malloy in the room. So they kicked him out, and he still doesn't have a copy of the budget at this point. So they don't expect him to sign it. So it's probably going to be a two-step process where he's going to have to veto it. They're going to have to come back and override his veto.
So when you say they got together and did this, who's the they? I mean, who are the key players in getting this thing together? Because we were dealing with Republican budgets, Democratic budgets, in some cases, Democratic budgets that were not in alignment with each other. I mean, who are we talking about that got this deal together?
They. So you have the Speaker of the House, Joe Arasimowitz, the House Majority Leader, Matt Ritter. You have House Minority Leader, Themis Claridis. You have the Senate President, Martin Looney, and Senate Republican President Len Fasano. And they all got into a room. All the principals got into the room, and they worked until the early hours for, I want to say it was a process over about 14, 15 days of just pure negotiation, and they were able to come to a conclusion.
Okay, so and before we get a little bit more analysis in this, tell us some of what we think is in this bill. I mean, Governor Malloy still hasn't seen the numbers, and he's right. Going to do whatever he does with it. We can talk about that in a moment. But what's in this this compromise they put together?
In the compromise, on what Republicans really wanted was they really wanted to be able to change the state's relationship with labor in 2027 when the current contract expires. They did not get that. Teachers will have to contribute 1% more of their salary to their pensions, and the state will lower its contribution. So we're not necessarily stabilizing the teachers' retirement fund by doing that, but apparently it works out in this budget. We're going to cut the University of Connecticut by $65 million a year. There's going to be an increase in the cigarette tax of 45 cents. Somehow we're going to pull off a hospital tax and get more federal reimbursement if that ever happens.
Mm.
There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of moving pieces there. It is kind of, you know, there are holes that could crop up fairly quickly.
Well, in some of the budget plans that were put forward, both by Democrats and Republicans, I mean, there were already holes in those budgets. Is there a sense that this is a balanced budget, that this is a budget that would pass any sort of muster by a third party looking at it?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that there is a sense that there's a balanced budget that does ask the governor to kind of handle a little bit more of the budget than it did previously, about $10 million more a year. But, you know, I suspect it's balanced. I have not seen a paper document yet. Mm.
Christine, I just had one quick question. Yeah. Have the caucuses seen this budget?
They did. They were in yesterday. And so the House Democrats came in yesterday at 5:30, which was a half hour after the lobbyists were kicked out of the Capitol.
Right.
And the House Republicans were meeting at 3:00, and they went over the budget for a very lengthy period of time. So they've seen it.
And they met a couple times, too. I think they met last week, at least House.
Did.
I know the House guys did. And I think that's where you got some of that initial feedback that they kind of met again for long, you know, meetings about, you know, making some changes to things at their caucus. So they think this has sort of been an iterative process.
I mean, one of the complaints that's been directed at this, and I'm not even sure how I feel about it, is that this process, which, as Liz just said, is kind of stretched out across a week in a way, has been maybe even less transparent to the public than most of the budget processes of the past, and those weren't very transparent either. So the historic complaint, the complaint that comes up every year is, A, that it's not a very transparent process, and B, that this thing, this whopping big thing, lands on everybody's desk with a minimal amount of time for people to really go through it and try to figure out what it really says. Republicans typically, and not unreasonably, complain that they're even more cut out of the process. It's an even bigger shock to them what's in there, and they have not enough time to really kind of figure it out before they have to start debating and voting. It seems as though, but with, you know, Republican participation this time, that problem really didn't get solved. I don't know, Christine, you know much more.
No,
about
I
this.
Mean the problem didn't get solved, you know, but it was Republicans were in the room, so
right.
You know they both agreed that, you know, this is the way forward, and they both had information
right.
to pass along to their caucus.
You know, one thing to think about, and I don't think this is like a partisan perspective at all. I think we're in a crisis, and so in the situation that we're in, 100. How many? You've got a countdown. What is it? We're 116.
117.
I
yes.
missed a day. Days without a budget. You know, I think that there are ways to try and open that process and be transparent. You know, obviously, you're missing the big pieces of that, which are budget, you know, meetings and hearings and public hearings and things like that. We've got towns that need money, and we've got, you know, things that need to be funded. So I think maybe, and again, this isn't a partisan perspective, but maybe the situation is so dire that, you know, we have to forego some of those things in you know, the effort of getting a budget. But I wonder, Christine, and are there things that can be done after the fact that make it?
Well, I think that everything that they're doing, nothing is a surprise.
Sure,
aside
yeah.
from the elimination of the motor vehicle tax,
which they pulled back on. Yeah.
So everything was debated either in Senate A or Senate B. And so everything was on the table as its own, you know, piece of the puzzle.
I guess I'm just unmoved by this idea that, well, we're in a crisis.
Sure.
And so we have to have different parliamentary procedures. Look, we do this every single year. Every single year there's a crisis.
Right.
The crisis is different. It's of their own making. We do things at the last possible second. We don't know what's in the bill.
Yeah, just not when the World Series is happening, typically.
Right.
We do this at a different time of year. And yeah, I mean, I hear what you're saying, Liz, although the reason that we're in a crisis is not some kind of Romulan plot against
no.
us. I mean, the reason we're in a crisis is because of these people who now have the crisis as an excuse for why they can't present the budget in an orderly fashion.
Well, I mean, I don't know if it's necessarily these people. I mean, I think there are plenty of budgets. The Republicans had a budget that they could have voted on long ago, back in May, long before Democrats had a budget. And certainly nobody wanted the governor's budget. And so that wasn't in play in the legislative process. So I guess maybe if they had voted on a Republican budget earlier in the year and then and moved that through. But, you know, I think it's the dynamics up there when you've got, you know, almost a split legislature, you're going to have, you know, some gridlock. But I think to the credit of the leaders in both parties, you know, they've come to a compromise, and it looks like they're willing to bring something to their respective caucuses that doesn't require the governor's support.
I just want to pick up on something that you mentioned, this whole idea that for a minute, a fleeting half a day, we'd heard that there was a negotiation around eliminating the car tax. Mm-hmm. This is something that, you know, everyone in Connecticut knows about. You pay this property tax on your cars. It's something that is, some people feel is onerous. It's the end of the year, and you do that. And then for a day, we heard they're going to get rid of that. And then half a day later, it's back in the books. And I think one of the problems, to Colin's point about transparency, just the way this whole process works, is I might well, having read your stories about it or other people's stories about it that day, believe, I don't know, that next April I wouldn't have to pay a car tax. But now, once again, I've got a car tax. And I just – there's something about that part of the process that seems so wrong-headed, convoluted, keystone copish. I just can't
I completely agree. I mean, it was maddening and frustrating. You've got to remember everything that's in – a two-year, $41 billion budget and be like, is this in it? Is this in it? Is this in it? Is this in it? Wait a minute. I forgot to ask about this. Is this in it? You know? And so it's like you hope somebody else asks the question about that because you're focused on this and you know, you're piecing together a budget by question instead of seeing an actual document. So I think that Governor Malloy last Friday when, you know, he said he thinks that it's silly that we're reporting on a budget that doesn't exist on paper, you know, he's partially correct.
I would like to point out that in 2006, in her state budget address, Jody Rell proposed eliminating the burdensome and regressive car tax.
Yes.
Well, and the governor did in 2013, too. Right. I mean, that was the last time, though, that we had a debate about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. So Liz, where do we go moving forward? So the governor finally will get a chance to look at something, and he's going to, what, veto this, and it's going to be overridden? He's going to sign off on this budget?
I mean, if you're asking me to get inside Governor Malloy's head, I'm probably the wrong person. You know, I think the state is in a, talk about long and protracted, bitter divorce with Governor Malloy at the moment. And I think we're trying to figure out how we move forward. And I think the legislative caucuses have decided they're not going to, you know, let the governor put kids in the middle, and they're going to do what they need to do to fund schools. And it's up to him if he wants to veto whatever they do. And, you know, I would say that legislators are going to have to take a look politically and say, you know, am I going to vote for or against funding public education in my towns?
What does he do, Christine?
If it quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. So, you know, the governor announced back in March that he's not running for reelection. So at that point, you know, the lawmakers, I think, were able to come together and reach this budget agreement knowing, and they knew that in order to get some of these things through, that he wasn't going to like what was in the package. I mean, last night, Joe Arasimowitz was like, you know, right now I can name off 10 things that are going to be objectionable to the governor, even though we know where he stands on these various issues. We just couldn't accommodate that.
And Colin, a quick thought?
I don't know. I don't entirely buy the positioning of Governor Malloy as some kind of mad king, you know, some kind of George III. I mean, yes, he's vetoed a budget so far. I think the legislature is very eager to pin the blame for the stasis and stagnation on Malloy. I don't think that's reasonable. I mean, I think they choked. I think both parties choked in different ways here. And now, because Malloy has such poor approval ratings, it's convenient to whack him on this, but I'm not really quite sure that that's where the blame lies.
Well, I agree with you on the latter point that because the governor is so unpopular, it makes it easy for folks to sort of push the blame to him. But I also think he made it very clear from the beginning that it was sort of his way or the highway. I mean, he put an aggressive budget together that made huge changes that I think he knew full well the legislature was never going to buy, and said from that moment, basically, if it doesn't do what I want to do, I'm not going to be part of the process and I'm not going to sign it. And I think you've heard that from the speaker and from Representative Claritas and from from Senator Fasano as well. I mean, he really took himself out of this process by sort of saying, yeah, if it's not mine, I'm not going to sign it.
I don't disagree with that. I mean, I think he did kind of take himself out. He pulled himself out of the room, you know, whether he agrees with that analysis or not, but by making these position statements.
A last thing for you, Christine, before we move on. You mentioned something else in there. The lobbyists got kicked out of the Capitol? What?
Yeah. So the lobbyists last night, the clock struck 5 o'clock, in which the building officially
turned into a pumpkin.
Apparently closes at 5 o'clock.
Did we find a glass slipper?
No. And so the building closes at 5 o'clock. So if you're not there and you don't have an appointment, there was, and if you weren't invited by a lawmaker to stay for any reason, you were being asked to leave.
So I
know it's the public's building, but apparently it's not the public's building after 5 o'clock.
You work as a member of the working press.
Yes.
You weren't invited by any lawmakers. Why were you allowed to stay?
Well, I would assume that I'm protected by the Constitution, but they did not ask the media to leave.
So a question, why wouldn't lobbyists or other onlookers be protected by the same Constitution?
They should be, as members of the public. They should be protected by the same Constitution and be able to stay. I mean, I would argue that they should have been allowed to stay. I think even the Speaker of the House... when he texted me, "What's happening?" was surprised by that decision. So it was the Capitol Police who made the decision.
I mean, I think we can say lobbyists are in a slightly different position. They are a slightly different caste. They are a regulated species in the state capitol in a way that nobody else has to. There are ropes that they have to stand behind. If
of
one
course.
Of them touches your garment, you have to wash your garment. There's all kinds of rules. It's like the Old Testament. But it seems bizarre and it seems capricious and out of the blue. I mean, we've all worked up there at the state capitol. I mean, it is a place, it's like a casino. I mean, there's, you know, it just sort of keeps going and going.
And nothing ever happens.
There's an idea for slot machines.
But nothing ever happens until after 5 o'clock.
Right.
That's the thing that's most egregious about what you just described.
And one thing that I would just like...
But they weren't technically
in session. Who makes that call,
though? So they're in a private caucus. They're not in any sort of, you know, public session. So even though they're there, they're not there in any capacity that the public could participate with them with.
They've never done that on a special session day or anything.
No,
like,
not on a special session day. If they were in session, they wouldn't be able to do that.
And I think, but you know, all joking aside, I mean, people have a bad image of lobbyists, but there are all kinds of different lobbyists. In a weird way, the lobbyists of the state capitol are kind of an ecosystem where you've got CBIA, but you've also got Common Cause. In other words, you have some watchdog groups who are lobbyists. You have lobbyists from
municipalities.
From municipalities. So it's not just sort of, you know, greasy, grubby.
No, it's not the sinister nature that I think people maybe.
It's an ecosystem. And that's one of the problems with this by invitation only thing.
Yes.
Because you disrupt the ecosystem at that point. So, you know, if Sherry Quickmire or somebody doesn't get invited to stay up there, then, you know, but one group of citizens doesn't have the same voice.
And I'll just quickly, Christine. So, and who enforced this? I mean, who?
It was the Capitol Police.
So the Capitol Police, again, kicked out lobbyists, lobbyists who were lobbying on behalf of just, you know, Joe and Jane who live in Cheshire. Anyway, so there's that. Secondly, they're going to go back in session tonight, right?
They are going to go into session
7
tonight.
7 o'clock.
The Senate is going into session at 7 o'clock.
Are they kicking everyone out?
No. No, they can't do that when they're in session. Can't do that.
Ridiculous. Christine Stewart, editor-in-chief of CTNewsJunkie.com. Liz Kerenowitz, Republican political analyst. Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about Jeff Flake, Bob Corker, and Donald Trump, and also some other things that the GOP did in Washington. And we're going to take a look at a brand new poll that asks people what they think about living in Connecticut. You can join us in the wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. We're talking about the week's news with Liz Kerenowitz, who's a Republican political analyst, Christine Stewart, editor-in-chief of CTNewsJunkie.com, and our own Colin McEnroe, who hosts The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hey, Colin, what's on your show today?
Well, you may have noticed that it rained very hard last night.
It did.
In Connecticut, there are 4,000 dams. And some of them are very nice and atmospheric, and some of them are like the dam in Chinatown where, you know, people can murder you or something. But some of them, many of them are not in very good shape, and some of them are so rickety that, you know, a big rainstorm like last night's could cause a terrible thing to happen. But we're going to look at the whole spectrum of that. I mean, from the maintenance of dams to their lovely and atmospheric qualities.
We should talk. Over my program next, we've been covering dams up in Maine and Vermont. Some dams that people are actually rebooting and trying to make electricity off
right.
of.
Well, there's some. We'll be talking about a proposal in Collinsville to do the same.
Very interesting. Okay, so a dam conversation this afternoon on the Colin McEnroe Show. Yesterday in Washington, some fairly remarkable stuff. Republican Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona, who's been sparring with President Donald Trump over the course of the last couple months, takes to the floor of the Senate and makes a pretty long and pretty impassioned speech. Amongst the things he says, if I've been critical, it's not because I relish criticizing the behavior of the President of the United States. If I've been critical, it's because I believe that it is my obligation to do so as a matter of duty and conscience. So that's Jeff Flake, sort of in the same day that Bob Corker is calling the president a liar. I don't know. This is a running theme for us, Colin. There's some version of Trump versus his Republican potential colleagues every week. This feels a little bit different in part because of some of the way that Jeff Flake spoke yesterday.
I think it's not just Jeff Flake and Bob Corker, too. I think it's George W. Bush and I think it's John McCain. I mean, now you have kind of an infield of prominent Republicans who have separated themselves from the rhetoric and conduct of President Trump, using not identical language, but very similar kinds of language. So the critique that's coming, I mean, Corker probably has the most extreme critique of the bunch, which is that he's going to get us all killed. But other than that, they're talking very much the same way. And they're talking the way a reasonable, rational person beholding very unpresidential behavior would talk. And I would just assume, you know, that other shoes are going to drop. I mean, it's in a way, when you get somebody like President Bush and then McCain and then these two guys to do this, you're kind of creating a more permissive environment to speak your mind.
Well, we heard former President Bush in the opening to the program, his long speech, not exactly naming Trump. I think that there is something interesting, though, and we'll get to it in a moment, about the way, Liz, the Republican Party is in many ways fracturing around issues having to do with Donald Trump and his base, cohering around other ideas that are certainly in the party's best interest. I mean, what do you see in the Bob Corker, Jeff Flake, John McCain, maybe George W. Bush and others taking on the president in a more head-on way right now?
Well, I think it's interesting when you look at, you know, just so there's the political aspect of it and certainly the public facing aspect of it. And then there's the policy aspect of it. It's been a much more substantive group of Republicans in the legislative process who have said, you know, this, whether it's the process itself or the substance of some of the policies that they didn't sign on to. That's included, you know, Lindsey Graham, Ben Sasse, Susan Collins. And it's not exactly, you know, I mean, a lot of people that get, you know, sort of that rhino moniker used to be a more partisan, a more substantive policy piece. I mean, Jeff Flake is a 96% rating among conservative groups for his voting record in his time in Congress. So it's sort of to your point, I think it is about, you know, the rhetoric and the substance of the dialogue rather than the substance of the policies. And so, you know, when you look at some of the contests to come here, you know, you've got Alabama, and that Senate race is very interesting. You know, sort of the Donald Trump-like candidate right now, the Real Clear Politics average has him only up 6 points.
Well, the Donald Trump-like candidate who Donald Trump didn't support.
Yes, yeah, very interesting dynamic there. But
if he'd known about him sooner, he
probably
would have.
Right, right. But I think when you – so – but that's a seat where in Alabama, I mean, that's a solid red state,
right,
where a Republican usually wins that state by about 14 points. The Fox News poll has them tied even. And so I think outcomes in races like that, you know, may provide a little bit more leverage for some of the folks in the party, you know, like John McCain, Ben Sasse, Jeff Flake, you know, to sort of say, you know, we need to temper the language. And I also think that in order to achieve policy outcomes, you have to have good politics. And the president went to Washington without a real coalition of legislators to build from. And it's one of the things that I've said his entire presidency. You've got to, you know, the politics have to be right to achieve policy outcomes. And you look at the failures on the policy end of things, I think a lot of it goes back to the politics.
I mean, I think what – I mean, first of all, Liz makes a lot of great points. And I would just sort of add to that that right now the chorus is – you know, George W. Bush, painter of light, and then three senators who are basically at the end of their Senate careers, So, I mean, people with actual skin in the game or people with a lot to lose haven't necessarily come forward. But as they start looking at the kind of calculus that Liz just sketched out, you may see people in Senate races saying, I just can't really run on this basis. You know, I mean, I don't think Roy Moore is going to say that. But, I mean,
no.
there may be Republicans who actually are planning to return to the Senate who say, I can't run without separating myself from this guy because he's toxic.
Well, and one more point, you know, Jeff Flake, in some of the conversations he's had since he announced his retirement, said he was retiring because he couldn't win a Republican primary.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't because, you know, really he no longer wanted to serve in the Senate. He felt it was a political calculation. He couldn't win a Republican primary. So, you know, I think there's something we have to do about that. But I think we also have to look long term. How do we win elections after Donald Trump? I mean, he's only going to be president for, you know, 4 or 8 years. And then we've got to, you know, figure out what we do from there. And there's whole sections of building a coalition to win elections in the long term that we need to figure out.
To be fair, there could be a nuclear holocaust in the middle that would change that calculation.
Ask
somewhat.
Senator Corker, I suppose.
Draining the swamp one Republican at a time. Unintended consequences.
Bannon would probably agree with you.
Yeah. Well, when you talk about the politics of this, I just have to point out that, you know, Tom Perez, the not entirely beloved head of the Democratic Party, his reaction to Senator Flake taking to the floor of the Senate, giving a 17-minute speech in which he speaks his truth and talks about how he doesn't want to be part of a party that is running the way it is right now. His reaction is, Senator Flake voted with Donald Trump 91% of the time. His retirement is a symbol of a Republican Party whose leaders allow Donald Trump's divisive politics. Essentially, Colin, you know, kicking him on the way out. And when I think about the Democratic Party, sometimes I think to myself, okay, so you've got Republicans, maybe who are leaving, they're on you know, their last gasp here or whatever, but are standing up to a president and starting to say things that more Americans would like to hear Republicans say. If you're going to win elections in a world in which you're going to have more type Republicans winning primaries, wouldn't you think that Democrats might want to build some sort of a voters coalition of people who would vote Democratic anyway and people who would prefer a Jeff Flake type Republican to somebody else? I mean, instead, the Democratic Party once again kind of shoots itself in the foot over this, at least by my reading.
John, you are adorable. No, that would be wonderful. That would be wonderful if that were true. If you were running the Democratic Party, I have no doubt that you would, in fact, do something like that. And it would be really good for America and good for civic life. Right now, they're raising money. That's kind of what they're doing right now. And it doesn't them know. Let me just say that a certain Republican analyst who I ran into at one of the presidential debate screening parties when it looked like Hillary Clinton was going to win the presidency said to me, we're going to be able to raise money off her for not just 8 years, but 20 years. I can't think who that was who said that to me. But I mean, that's what they're doing right now. They're raising money. So Jeff Flake does them no good. I mean, Jeff Flake or anybody acting reasonable on the Republican side is of no use to Tom Perez. He doesn't care about it. He would rather try to squish Jeff Flake back into the Trump corral than salute him for his independent thinking at this moment. And that's because this is a terrible world we live
in. That sounds so cynical, Liz. I just don't know.
I couldn't imagine. I think one thing that sort of rang to me is I think it's hysterical that Democrats are talking about issues within the Republican Party when they're still failing to find someone to lead their party. I mean, you know, Hillary Clinton, Nancy Pelosi, you know, these are the leaders of that party's yesterday, and they have yet to find today or tomorrow's leader. And frankly, until they do that, they're going to continue to lose elections in spite of the fact, you know, that congressional polls, you know, have them up. Donald Trump is underwater among, you know, sort of the general population while maintaining a very strong base. Democrats are not offering anyone an alternative, and you can't beat someone with no one. And so, you know, I think they've got to get it together and stop playing the identity politics game that they're so want to play. And I'm, you know, I'm certainly not a Democrat advisor, but, you know, I think we've got a lot more to offer in terms of substance and direction than what the Democrats have put on the table.
Really quickly, I was going back and forth with somebody on Twitter about this last night. When you say identity politics, what do you mean?
I think that what it means is every time something happens there, you go directly to a personal issue or you find a way to divide. Some of what you were saying about the Jeff Flake stuff is there's always got to be an identifier that distinguishes you from somebody else, and it's going to be personal or it's going to be something that you can sort of exacerbate into a bigger problem.
But isn't that just politics? I mean, isn't the whole point making a distinction between you and the other person, whoever that other person is? That's like the whole idea of politics. Like, I stand for this and you stand for this and I'm better than you. Vote for me.
It's more personal, I think, in some of the ways that I have seen Democrats play it. They lash out and make huge accusations about people without having any cause to do that or say things without a base. And I that's certainly true, I think, of both people, both parties. But I just find it to be so much more of an issue among Democrats that they have to find a way, to call names and make things about personal issues.
In the first time in the history of the Wheelhouse, Colin McInerney just raised his hand because he wanted to speak.
It has to be said that 2016 was a campaign about identity politics. When you say that white voters are aggrieved and left behind and that they are disadvantaged compared to people of color, that's identity politics.
Yeah.
When you say Muslims are a huge problem, that's identity politics. When you say that people coming over from Mexico are rapists and drug dealers, that's identity politics.
I agree with
you. So Donald Trump's campaign was a white identity politics. I mean, identity politics isn't just LGBTQ stuff or black stuff or brown stuff. It's also white stuff.
I agree.
So let's just quickly move. We were talking a little bit about the substance of things. So this is what's interesting. And maybe this gets to Tom Perez's earlier point. Jeff Flake makes a nice speech. He calls out Donald Trump. Bob Corker's on the other side. John McCain's on the other side. It seems like all the Republicans are on the same side as they vote to eliminate a rule that would allow consumers to sue financial institutions. Mike Pence, the vice president, cast the deciding vote Tuesday night, breaking a tie in the Senate to defeat a new rule that would have ensured consumers that they had the right to sue financial institutions rather than being compelled to accept arbitration or combat wrongdoing. It was drafted by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. I'm reading this out of Slate. Well, it looks like the Republicans can get together on something. This feels like a pretty good win for, your Wells Fargos of the world, Liz.
I mean, I think you got to get a win somewhere, I suppose.
on the backs of a whole bunch of people who got screwed by banks, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm not as familiar, I guess, with the substance of the bill or but I think you're going to see a lot of contentious issues where you're going to have Republicans breaking with the president and the vice president and promoting an agenda that, they think better serves their constituents. And they've done that consistently throughout the last 9 months.
Wait, what did you see in this bill, Colin?
Well, I think, first of all, this is not an isolated thing. What's basically happened, and particularly inside the White House, not so much as in Congress, there's obviously a war going on any Obama-era regulations or new ideas of any kind. And in this case, I first of all think that the more the public knows about stuff like this, the more upset they're going to get. Maybe I'm wrong. And obviously, I'm the kind of person who, when I'm listening to Elizabeth Warren talk about all this stuff, I say, yes, we under-regulated to our peril going into 2008. We didn't do anywhere near enough about it. And then what was done about it is now being undone. And one of the things that is the most frustrating is that there's no stick to go along with carrots. It's very difficult to punish people who behaved cynically and to the detriment of their customers. And this looked like an attempt to do it. And yeah, I mean, I would have liked to have seen it go forward.
Let's take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about a new poll out of Sacred Heart University that asks people sort of what they think about living in Connecticut in a variety of ways. We'll also find out what the state of Connecticut and some of the municipalities here were thinking about trying to lure Amazon headquarters here, and talk about an interesting court case as well. It's all coming back when we get back on The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky, and we're talking about the week's news with Liz Karantowicz, who's a Republican political analyst, Christine Stewart, editor-in-chief of CTNewsJunkie.com, and our own Colin McEnroe from The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. We saw a new statewide poll by Sacred Heart University's Institute for Public Policy, and they asked a bunch of questions about how Connecticut residents feel about living here, quality of life. And let's get to some of those things in just a moment, Christine. But I think all of us on this panel are somewhat perplexed a little bit about another one of the polling institutes in the state, certainly the most famous one, the most well-regarded one at Quinnipiac University, not really polling on any of these issues. And I don't know, that does kind of have an impact on how people think and feel about these issues.
No, it definitely does. I mean, we did a story at the end of August and I was like, wait a minute, where's Quinnipiac been on some of this stuff? You know, should we be legalizing marijuana? Should we be, you know, instituting tolls on the highway? Where does the public stand? I think that, you know, like it or not, they were able to give lawmakers some sort of insight and credible insight to what the Connecticut residents were thinking about some of these issues. And that was completely missing during this legislative session.
Yeah, I mean, it would be great to have the Q poll because also, I mean, it's a poll that we are, well, I mean, I'm stealing Liz's line, but she's absolutely right about this. I mean, you want to see trend lines too. So you can't plot trend lines if you don't poll very often. I mean, the trend lines, you're connecting dots that are too far apart.
Yeah, I think tracking, you know, the value that the Q poll provides is, you know, something we're all familiar with. We kind of understand their methodology. And I think there's, you know, the tracking issue of being able to know, okay, well, sort of historically speaking, this is where Republicans, Democrats, Independents, you know, voters have been on these issues.
So let's just cherry pick some highlights that I pulled out, and some of you may have some other highlights out of this this poll. One in three residents, about 30%, believe that the overall quality of life in Connecticut is declining. This number increases to 34.3% among those earning at least $150,000, but falls to 28% among those residents earning $50,000 or less. One in five residents under the age of 35 reported their quality of life is improving. So we've been hearing this, I don't know, Liz, for quite some time about, you know, it costs a lot to live here in Connecticut. I don't know. Is this showing us anything about how people feel about the quality of life here?
I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, for me, from a research standpoint, you know, were there open-ended questions after that where they asked why? Were there some things that they sort of asked as a follow-up to say, okay, tell us, you know, what are the issues that you think are going to, you know, either improve or what are the things that have declined to make you feel that way? You know, when you're doing a research instrument, those are the kinds of things you ask a sort of like a question and then you follow it up. So I'd love to see some of the additional data.
A little bit of detail in there under their column.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to back up. And I mean, Liz and I are both clearly poll geeks. But I mean, this is a frustrating poll because it's hard. The data is presented in this kind of melange of razzle-dazzle bar graphs and pie graphs as opposed to actually showing us questions and crosstabs where we can really kind of drill down and see what the data is. This is also a poll of Connecticut residents, which, I mean, they're not really detailed about explaining their methodology, and that's really important. In terms of knowing how much weight to put on any of the stuff that we're about to talk about, I don't know. This seems like a soft poll to me a little bit, unless I know more about it. Connecticut residence is not a good screen, right? That's like, you know, you could be saying, so you live here, ruff, ruff. No, you like live in a house here, ruff, ruff. Okay, good, that's fine. I mean, really, you know, dogs can answer this poll.
There's also a question, I have a question about, I don't think that they might be doing some live questioning.
It's a mix of phone and digital, that's not unusual anymore. They're doing that to make up for some of the problems with landlines and cell phones
and
stuff like that.
But I think where Quinnipiac was really successful, it was registered voters.
And you knew which partisan, how many unaffiliated, and they would break down likely voters. That's what we want. Likely voters is gold.
And
that's where you can, to your point about, you know, sort of having a conversation about the substance of the policies at the Capitol, when you know that people, you know, there's skin in the game. There's no interest like self-interest. Everyone wants to get reelected. And so if they know where people stand on some of these issues, you know, to your point, they're a little more likely to move.
Well, right. And maybe in some of the tales that are in there, we find out a little bit of the problems with the methodology. So, for instance, Connecticut residents agree, according to the poll, regardless of demographic profile, that, quote, creating new sources of tax revenue is the preferred method of addressing Connecticut's budget crisis over cutting funding to public programs. Then elsewhere, the areas of greatest concern among Connecticut residents are the high overall tax burden. 90% of people say that. So I don't know, Christine. Right. Basically, what we're saying is the only way to really solve the budget problems is to raise taxes. But boy, are our taxes too high.
Right, exactly. It's kind of like it doesn't make sense.
But in there, one of the things they said was finding new sources of revenue, which is always like a cute, I think, more of like a Democrat way of saying we're going to raise your taxes. But I think it was like finding new sources of revenue, not raising taxes per se, but it was on, you know, recreation. recreational marijuana right. and yeah. things like that. It was yeah. finding new revenue, not necessarily raising taxes.
Right. Pot pulled very well.
Yeah. yeah.
Taxing, legalizing and taxing pot way, way outperformed tolls.
And which, the media did well in this poll, too. I was just looking at it.
Another reason you can't trust it.
Nearly three quarters of residents reported being either very or somewhat aware of the state of Connecticut is in a budget crisis. So congrats to all of you for getting the word out.
Every single person is actually listening to this program right now. I think that's the only way we could possibly assume that those numbers came out. They're all listening right now, and they're the ones who answered the call. Okay, well, speaking of answering calls, a lot of calls going into Amazon headquarters, lots of people trying to ply Jeff Bezos and get these 50,000 jobs that he's promised. Municipalities all over the country decided they were going to jump into this bidding. Connecticut had sort of an interesting dual bid, Colin, that I read through a very kind of funny and interesting piece by Susan Bigelow on ctnewsjunkie.com about this. But they present this two-horn proposal, one of which is, hey, you could locate in Stamford, real near New York City, a lot of stuff already built there. Or you could locate in Hartford, and we'll build you a Ferris wheel.
Right. So And there's others around. I mean, Mark Boughton made a video, I think, about Danbury, and there's some kind of dual town proposal up by the northern border, and there's all kinds of – I mean, I guess – I don't know. What I would say about this, just in a macro sense, is that, you know, when Jeff Bezos first did this, I thought, well, maybe what he's really trying to do is a public service, which is to get American communities to inventory themselves and say, well, what do we have that's good and what do we have that's bad? And how come we haven't built more mass transit, for example, because that seems to be important? You know, kind of a little moment of soul searching. I mean, I no longer feel that way. And I think this is just the most exaggerated version of what's become a very destructive type of public policy, which is to offer these Santa's bags of goodies to companies to get them to locate in your state rather than another. And some of that winds up being kind of a race to the bottom too. I mean, Bezos tried to make it a race to the top by saying, here's what's really important to us, an educated citizenry, you know, mass transit, stuff like that. But, you know, he also, like everybody else, wants whatever goodies you can give him.
Okay. And we do certainly on this program spend an awful lot of time, Liz, carping about big giveaways to corporations, either to get them to stay or to lure them here. I mean, this is sort of that whole idea on steroids, but is it still worth Connecticut jumping into the ring?
Well, you know, I read the, you know, the column, and I think, you know, I think there's some merit to what your initial thought, Colin, about the fact that it gets people to sort of think big about their communities. But, you know, I think the underlying issue here is we need to do a better job as a state of having a vision to build an economy, grow an economy naturally and organically from the ground up, and think of ways to make ourselves more attractive, not just to the Jeff Bezos of the world, but to the manufacturers that are leaving the state, and to the small businesses that are opting to go, you know, locate elsewhere, and to the companies that have decided that that this is no longer the place they want to call home. And I think we collectively need a new leader who will think more broadly about a bottom-up strategy rather than a top-down strategy, where there's a leader who says, I'm going to pick winners and losers, not just in business, but in municipalities, and I'm going to pit regions, and I'm going to pit cities, and I'm going to do these things against it. We need somebody that's going to say a rising tide will lift all boats, so that when the Jeff Bezos of the world come, we've got a best foot forward, and we're not, you know, trying to pick a winner.
Well, one of the things I think that's, I don't know if it's a little bit troubling about the Connecticut proposal, Christine, as I look at it, and there's on Susan's page here on ctnewsjunkie.com, there's a great rendering that they have of all the skyscrapers that would be built on both sides of the Connecticut River, on the Hartford side and on the East Hartford side, but also imagining all sorts of other things that are going to be done with highways, clearly, to make way for these skyscrapers, in that we would quickly render this futuristic world that looks like it comes from a sci-fi novel in the 1950s so quickly in response to an Amazon proposal, but that very rarely do we have these conversations, I think, amongst legislative leaders or leaders in the governor's office about this type of vision right now without a Jeff Bezos on the horizon. We're just not thinking this way unless somebody's bringing 50,000 jobs.
Well, I think we do to some extent. I mean, you know, this proposal kind of includes some of what Representative John Larson had proposed by tunneling over, you know, the highway right there, the 9184 interchange. It includes that as part of the proposal. So, you know, I think we have the ability to think big. I think that we just don't have the economy right now. Our tax structure hasn't kept up with the new economy. And it'd be great to land 50,000 jobs because pretty much overnight we would improve our economy.
But before we run out of time, I know, Colin, we often say that one of the undercovered parts of Connecticut government and civic life is obviously the state, the judicial branch, and I think you've brought us a case that has all the makings of something that people should be really, really interested in. It has to do with fighting words. Maybe you can take us through the Supreme Court case.
Right, about the coarsening of public life. The case refers to – this is a case that was decided by the state Supreme Court. State prosecutors are now petitioning for the U.S. Supreme Court to hear this case. When I tell you all that, then you're going to be surprised by what I'm talking about. It involves an altercation that happened at a Stop and Shop where a disgruntled customer showed up for some kind of Western Union, like money transfer, and it wasn't available. And went off on the night manager and called the night manager kind of every name in the book, including one that begins with C, which is, I think most of us agree, one of the most loathsome things that you can call somebody. The night manager held it together. The customer left, and then the police were called, and it became a breach of peace case. And so there's a doctrine called fighting words. I mean, you have freedom of speech, but there's something called fighting words, which words that could very easily provoke a physical retaliation. That's a special category, and you can be prosecuted under certain circumstances for that. The state Supreme Court, with Justice Andrew McDonald writing for the majority, said that these weren't fighting rules because of the context mainly. He also explored the whole question of whether our discourse has become so coarse that the C word and words like it are no longer carry the same weight, although he kind of dropped that line ultimately in his opinion and said, no, it's really more the context. This is the night manager of a Stop and Shop. They just know stuff like this is going to happen, and so they kind of get ready for it or something. And so I doubt the Supreme Court's going to hear this, but I mean, it's just sort of mind-boggling to me. And I'm turning – not just because I'm hanging around with Liz today, but like I'm turning into George Will or David Brooks or something. David Brooks got cursed at for 10 minutes at a Washington Nationals game recently and got a column out of it, of course.
Of course he got a column. But okay, so is it possible that the coarsening of our language has changed the calculation that much, Liz, over time? Maybe even over the last 6 or 8 months?
I don't know. I mean, I think people unfortunately are willing to say – and do things maybe they weren't willing to say and do before. But so you're of the sense that the fighting words should stay, that if you say certain things, somebody should have – is sort of covered. Is that what your position is?
No. I mean, first of all, I think fighting words is a very questionable doctrine to begin with. I mean, basically what's happened, I think, is over time law has tried to carve out some set of exceptions to free speech, right? There are ways in which we know that incendiary language and other circumstances is not covered by free speech. Speech that's assaultive that you can't get away from, somebody screaming at you in a bus, something like that, is not covered. And so they're looking for this other place. Like, is there stuff that if you say it to somebody, it's just so horrible that your right to free speech isn't covered? And I think it's a shaky doctrine to begin with. But if it's going to exist, I don't know how. I mean, the language that's cited, and it's fully cited in the McDonald decision, I don't know how that isn't fighting words. Like, what would be fighting words? And he's saying, well, these would be fighting words if I just walked up to you on the street and started saying this stuff to you. But if you're a night manager at Stop and Shop, apparently you're not entitled somehow
with the idea, as you told us in an email, which is quite true, that if you went up to a Supreme Court justice, for instance, and you did that, you would probably go away in handcuffs.
And right. Same to a police officer, I assume. If you walked up and spoke to a police officer that way, just out of nowhere, I assume you'd probably be in trouble,
correct? There are decisions both ways on that.
Okay.
Well, cited in his decision.
And what happens with internet muscles? I mean,
right.
Like everybody has these internet
keyboard
muscles
warriors.
Now. And, like, everybody is like, you know, it says things online that just you wouldn't say to somebody's face.
Well, and yes, and increasingly we're seeing court cases show up where people are being prompted into some sort of action by online bullying, and that is an entirely different class of something.
Yeah. Something that, I tell my toddler, and I'm sure you do too, we all need to make better choices.
I like that. We'll end with that. We all need to make better choices. Liz Granowitz, a Republican political analyst. Thanks so much, Liz. Thanks also to Christine Stewart, editor-in-chief of ctnewsjunkie.com. Thanks, Christine.
Thanks, John.
And Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Thank you, Colin.
Still a Stop and Shop night manager. You love them.
Our program is produced by Katie Talarski. Thanks to Kion Wolf. I'm John Dankosky. Thanks for joining us.